Thanks for coffee. Okay, good morning. I'm thrilled to be here with all of you, especially on such a nice day. It's great to see everyone here inside. I want to be relatively brief so that we can leave some time for interaction, because I know there's a lot of great experience and knowledge in the room, and we'd like to share it with each other. For the last 5 years, I've been talking about the same things over and over again, just with new additions, and it just continually becomes a little bit worse. But I'll tell you my standard. I've probably given several hundred speeches about the roundups after 9/11, the detentions, the deportations, the FBI questioning, the spying on the mosques that have turned into the spying on the homes, that is, the spying on the, you know, on the phones and the emails. And, of course, special registration. I don't really want to talk about that today, although we can do, you know, right now in my remarks, but we can talk about that afterwards in question and answer. I'm just going to touch on something very specific. But to lead into that, I want to just briefly mention special registration, which many of you may remember was a program under the DOJ, under INS, that Ashcroft instituted, which was meant to, well, they initially rolled it out saying, this program is meant to register all male non-citizens of every country around the world who are present in the United States. We just want to know who they are, where they're from, why they're here, and have an opportunity to question them. And this will indeed be rolled out to all countries around the world. But the first list came out, and on the list were all Muslim-majority countries. So men and boys 16 and older were forced to go into these registration facilities, and without having been given notice, warning, nothing, just a random notice in the Federal Register, which nobody reads, which even lawyers argued about what it meant when they finally saw it. That said, look, you need to come down if you're in this category, in one of these Muslim countries, male, 16 or older here. And what we're going to do is we're going to fingerprint you, photograph you, and question you. If you don't come down, you've preemptively or presumptively shown bad faith. And that bad faith can be assumed that you really intend to do us harm, and you can be deportable and subject to criminal penalties, including jail time. So people started to panic, and we would find people, you know, hundreds of people finding out from phone calls from friends, hey, I heard this rumor. There's something going on. We have to go down to the INS the INS office. Some states didn't even have an INS office, so you literally had to drive from one state to another to get there. And then it was in the middle of winter, so there were these incredibly long lines and people standing out in some places in temperatures that were below freezing for hours and hours. And what ended up happening, a lot of us lawyers were able to get into those rooms, and what we found was happening were people were asked, fingerprinted, photographed, and asked questions like everything from how many times a day do you pray, tell me about your religion, what religious sect are you a part of, are you Sunni or are you Shia, things like where do you buy your meat to find out if people bought halal meat or not halal meat, what mosque do you go to, you know, just really ridiculous questions like people being shown a picture of Osama bin Laden and asking if they recognized this person, if they knew this person. And so a lot of people ended up in detention as a part of, you know, as a result of this program. You know, immigration in the United States is not an easy system. The administration likes to say, and they famously said, you know, immigration is like being pregnant. Either you are or you aren't. Legal or not. That's it. And that's not it at all. Because of our flawed immigration system, people sit in limbo for many, many years while they have good cause to stay here. So after special registration, which only actually registered all the Muslims and didn't register anybody else, people were frightened, incredibly frightened in the community, saying, you know, they are going to round us up. This is it. They're going to round us up and put us into detention. They're going to figure out a way. They're figuring out a way just to single out the Muslims. And you saw people stop, you know, people, Muslims stop participating in a lot of civic activities. Even, I mean, I remember after 9/11, in some majority Muslim neighborhoods, like in Brooklyn and Queens, some of the South Pakistani neighborhoods, you couldn't find people in the stores. People just stayed inside. They were scared, let alone mustering up the courage to go to a protest or to go out and, join up with a political group that was doing anything to counter what the administration was doing. And so the fear was huge. And one of the many rumors that came about was, hey, somewhere in the middle of the country, they're building a facility just for Muslims. And it's just for us. Get your bags ready. Either go to Canada or be prepared to put an emergency phone call and let somebody know where you are, because we're all going. And we're going somewhere. And so it was with a little bit of panic that people greeted the news in April of this past year that the Federal Bureau of Prisons said they were going to have a brand new prison system, a brand new unit. And let me tell you what it is first, because it actually exists. It opened up, it's operational as of December 11th, 2006. This is called the Communications Management Unit. It's at a federal penitentiary, and it houses almost exclusively Muslims. It's meant to house right now about 80 people, but I think there's far less, probably a little bit under 20 at this point. It's so new, only a couple months. Now, the Communications Management Unit, as you might guess from its name, is very restrictive in a way that most prisons are not. It's probably, it's not quite up to a supermax facility, but it's a little bit below that. You have extreme restrictions on prisoners' contacts with the outside world. And it's, our prison systems are an absolute horrific mess that violate international standards left and right. So these are standards that fall far below even the lousy ones that we've managed to keep in this country. So all telephone conversations happen on monitored lines. They must be in English. There is no speaking of your native language or any language. So if you have a family member who does not speak English, you're out of luck. They only happen in English. Now, they're all monitored, but it's not just recorded. There is someone actively listening live as you're speaking. Instead of the standard 300 minutes of telephone conversation that people would get a month who are housed in this federal prison, they get 60 minutes a month. That's about 15 minutes a week. And if the warden decides, at the warden's discretion, he or she can decide that they can get a maximum of 3 minutes a month. And that's it. Instead of full day visits that would happen either every week or every other week, you have the folks in this prison get visits for 2 hours twice a month, and that's it. And they are, presumably they are not contact visits. They are behind the plexiglass windows. All letters, with the exception of letters that are sent to Congress, letters that are sent to your attorney, and letters that are sent to the courts, are read and monitored and copied. Now, we all know that prison mail is monitored, but generally it's done fairly quickly. These have all their prison mail has a significant delay of several weeks. So how did this happen? How did we come up with this new kind of prison system that's not a supermax facility? And because federal law really does, once again, federal law says you can't do this, and federal law requires that a new program of this goes through a certain type of process. And then we end up back in April of 2006, where the U.S. Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is part of the Department of Justice, they proposed a new program that looked exactly like this Communications Management Unit, or very similar to it. And they said, look, this is only going to apply to terrorists or people who are terrorist-related inmates. And the language was so broad on who this could apply to, on how they could use it. It seemed to be able to put people who had no connection to terrorism in here. And in fact, the language was so broad. It said, I believe the exact language was, witnesses, detainees, or otherwise can be housed in here, which basically means people who have not been convicted of a crime. They could just be sent and housed in this prison. Well, you know, when this was open for public comments, as is the law, that as they have to do, in April, people were just kind of outraged, saying, look, this is just not acceptable. We don't, you know, once again, we don't do this in the United States, and this is against all of our laws. We don't do this, and you cannot do this. This violates the Constitution, not that they care, but it also violates basic international standards of human rights. And so they said, they seemed to pull it back. They said, okay, we're not going to do this. It seemed like the idea was tossed out the window, and it wouldn't be enacted. And then they went ahead, and as this administration likes to do, they went ahead and did it in secret. And lo and behold, December 11th, we ended up with what we thought we would never have. So how did this happen? It must have come from a direct order from one of the very high offices that oversees the U.S. Federal Bureau of Prisons in the Department of Justice. Those offices, so either one of these three people authorized this: the director of the Prison Bureau, someone at the head of the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel, or Alberto Gonzalez, our Attorney General, the highest law enforcement officer that we have in this country, who's shown absolutely no respect for law since he's been in office, and even before that in Texas. So all of this, again, in violation of federal law. They did not go through the normal channels to create this very new system. But this, so that's the first thing that makes this really, in my mind, illegal. The second thing is that there is extremely clear law. The Supreme Court has said in Johnson versus California, I think, it's a recent Supreme Court case, and it said, look, you can't separate people on the basis of race, religion, national origin, or language in our prisons. You just can't do that. So how are we ending up with a facility that's almost entirely Muslim? I believe they have one Bolivian in there. I think he was sent to mix it up. If he's in there, it's not. They're not violating the law because, look. So who else is there besides our Bolivian? We have five of the Lackawanna Six. I don't know if you remember the Lackawanna Six, but they were the boys up in the Yemenis up in upstate New York, who, and the short story is, they traveled over to Pakistan, and they said that they took part in a training camp at an Al Qaeda training camp and were so uncomfortable that they got out of it and they left, came back, and that's all they did. And they didn't want anything more to do with it, were scared. And when the FBI caught up with them and were about to prosecute them, they threatened them with sending them to Guantanamo, saying, look, we can do this now in this country. We can send you to Guantanamo, and you will never, if you don't plea, you will never hear or see your family, friends, a lawyer, a court, daylight again. We have Randall Royer, who's one of the Virginia paintball case. I don't know if you all know this case. It's an interesting case. The Virginia paintball case, in short, accused these kids of preparing for jihad by playing paintball in Virginia. And the funny story is, we were actually up last summer. I didn't tell you, but last summer we were up at, we were in upstate New York, and we were at the farm of a criminal defense attorney who does a lot of activism around, you know, Guantanamo stuff and detainees and prisoners. And my husband and I, we're both Muslim, we're going to play paintball. And we're getting the helmets ready, and then I looked at him and I said, Virginia. And we put it back. We said, no way in hell. I mean, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy, but that's the kind of intense fear you should have in this country, because they can do it. We still don't believe it in this country that they can do it to us. We don't believe that we don't believe they're reading our emails, that they're listening in on our phone lines, that when we send a letter, that it's being read, because the U.S. Postal Service, hey, that's fair game, the president just said. But it's happening. It's already happened, and it's funny because our realization is slowly creeping up. We don't believe that any one of us could walk out of this building and that's the last time we see daylight, because this government has said they have the ability, the authority, and the power now to take any one of us off the streets and disappear us forever on one person's say-so. We don't believe it, but it's true. And so you look at the people who are living this, and my personal favorite inmate there is Rafil Dafir. He's a 58-year-old Iraqi-American physician. He was born in Iraq. He came to the United States, by all accounts a good man, and he had organized a charity to send money back to Iraqi civilians who needed help, who were dying of malnutrition, who didn't have a place to live because of our sanctions and because of our wars. And because he violated the U.S. economic sanctions, he's now living in this facility. He's from Syracuse, upstate. So we have the facility now. I mean, if we didn't believe it a couple years ago when special registration came about and they asked all the Muslim men to line up and be counted, we should believe it now. We have this secret facility that when we stood up in April and said, this is wrong, you cannot do this, this violates all laws, and they said, okay, they erected it secretly a couple months later. And now we have it. It's operational. It's housing people. So that's how. So we have the facilities, but we also are seeing that on the front end of things, the administration is creating the policies and the practices to make it easier to put Muslims in prison for no reason or for a very small reason. And you know, I'm going to give you two examples. I'm going to give you a. A little bit of bad news and a little bit of good news. It's not good news for us, but it's in the United States, but it's good news for the world, comparatively. Turkman v. Ashcroft, back to the roundups that happened after 9/11, where you had folks kind of just picked up off the streets and disappeared. A lot of them were sent to detention facilities around the country, some in New York, some in New Jersey. People treated very poorly. And a huge percentage of the people who were picked up were Muslim men, mainly from Arab or South Asian countries, who had minor immigration violations. So people who came here on a tourist visa and overstayed, people here who were on a student visa and weren't taking enough credits. People who had come here, they had all their visa stuff in order, but they moved and they didn't notify the INS within 10 days that they moved. So then they had a problem with their visa. So a lot of these people were picked up on an immigration pretext, put into prisons, these immigration detention facilities, and then held, kind of just held indefinitely. The FBI had cleared them for deportation. The government said they wanted them for deportation. They could have deported them. They didn't. They just held on to them and held them in very, very poor and abusive conditions. What ended up happening was the Center for Constitutional Rights sued on behalf of a class of these men. And in the United States, so that was April 2002 that this lawsuit was filed. And last year, we got the very poor decision that says the executive of the United States is free to single out any nationals of any countries, of any particular countries that he wants. The executive branch can pick and choose based on race, religion, nationality, whatever, and keep these people in detention without regard to whether or not they've been cleared by the FBI, however long they want. And detaining indefinitely is okay as long as removal, as long as eventually you could reasonably foresee a time when you would let them out. So in other words, you can keep people forever so long as you can one day imagine letting them go. And then a couple weeks ago, the week of February 20th, I believe, we had, you know, Vince talked about the Hamdan case, and basically the Guantanamo detainees' fights. You know, the Guantanamo detainees had been thrown down there, 700 men thrown down there, and told, look, you're going to be here, it's a black hole, you're never going to see, you know, you're never going to be out, you're never going to see a lawyer, you're never going to see a court, you're never going to see anything. This is it for you. This is your life. Held, tortured, indefinitely. Some people have been let go. People like David Hicks, who's due to stand the military commission recently. He hasn't been shown this. He's from Australia. He's an outdoorsman, a rancher. He hasn't seen the sun in about 5 years. This is part of what they're doing to him. It's very deliberate torture. And who knows what kind of state he's in. So that same week, you know, we'd had a victory in the Supreme Court where the Supreme Court said, look, people have a right to come to court and ask, and these Guantanamo detainees have a right to come to court to say, hey, why am I being held? Let me hear the evidence against me, and let me present evidence to show you why this is not true. And they should have that opportunity. So in response, the Military Commissions Act was passed. You know, Bush pushed it through Congress, and Congress passed it that basically said, again, as Vince said, look, you have no right. We want to hold you and pick anybody up. We can hold them indefinitely, and that's the end of it. So an appeals court recently said, in the week of February 20th, an American appeals court said, you know what? Because of the Military Commissions Act, yeah, in the United States, we do allow people to be picked up and held indefinitely without ever seeing a court. Congress authorized it, and President Bush signed it in the Military Commissions Act. That's federal law, so Guantanamo detainees can never see the light of day if they so choose at the administration's level. A couple days later, Canada has decided something differently. They had a case similar to Turkmen, our Roundup case here in the United States, which basically said they have a law, and under that law, it's an immigrant and refugee law, and under that law, there was a special security certification provision. And this provision said, look, here in Canada, if we're putting someone through the process of removal, we can detain that person indefinitely while we're deciding their case. And in Canada, they decided no. Their high court said, absolutely not. This is not acceptable. We don't detain people indefinitely, even while deciding their status, which is actually, I mean, that's a stricter standard than we had been asking for in the United States. So it's, you know, it's good. If we can't generate good news here, it's good news to get it from our neighbors. I actually, you know, and I'm glad we had the Sala case. I'm actually going to speak at another panel. But there's a flip side. The Sala case is the guy who was just recently acquitted of being, you know, of Ashcroft tried to indict him on it and convict him based on a torture-induced confession. There's a cousin case. The exact same thing happened to another guy, American citizen in Virginia, and he's spending 30 years in prison. So while it's good news, it's, you know, there's not great news all around. So with that, that happy note, maybe we can open it up for questions.
Great.
Yeah.